Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello, thank you for joining me. Episode 35. This is with Jess Walter. This was surreal for me. He is absolutely one of my favorites. He is incredible. I am not the only one to call him a favorite. He's the author, Jess Walter is, of 9 books. Most recently, the national bestseller, The Cold Millions, and the number one New York Times bestseller, Beautiful Ruins. Incredible book. Beautiful Ruins was number one New York Times bestseller for 5 weeks. The Zero, he also wrote, is a finalist for the National Book Award, and Citizen Vince, which is a winner of the Edgar Award. In 2013, he published We Live in Water, his collection of short stories. In 2019, as you'll hear us talk about on the episode, President Barack Obama named the We Live in Water short story collection as one of his favorite reads of 2019. Wow. Jess Walter's work has been published in 32 languages, and his short fiction has appeared 3 times in Best American Short Stories. And he's one heck of a guy. I really appreciated his time. Very humble, very giving, and incredibly talented. You're in for a treat. Enjoy. This is episode 35. I'm pretty sure I have the number right. I have a couple that are in the can, as they say, so I think it's 35. Jess Walter. I cannot believe that I'm staring across the screen at Jess Walter, an incredible author. We're going to be talking about a lot of his work today, especially The Cold Millions, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, is a 2020 publishing date.
Yeah, October.
Beautiful Ruins, which is 2012. And yeah. We also have We Live in Water, which I'll mention in a minute for a couple different reasons, which is 2019, is a collection of short stories.
13, actually. It came out a year after Beautiful Ruins.
2013. How the heck did I? Okay. I must have bought it in 2000.
No, we discover books at all different times. That's what I love about them. They once they're out, they kind of exist in their own time.
Oh, exactly right. And again, thanks so much for joining me. I love your work. I'm not alone. You've gotten all kinds of accolades. Let's be honest. You had 5 weeks with Beautiful Ruins at number one. You have had so many other accolades with your books, but Barack Obama put We Live in Water. I think that's where the confusion comes in. I think he put it on his 2019 list.
He did. Yeah.
How did that feel?
I mean, it was so cool. It's funny, as an author, a book comes out, a book of short stories, which by nature is going to be smaller than a novel. And you kind of live in all the great responses from readers. And mm-hmm. I hate to say one reader's response is more impressive than the others, but mm-hmm. I have lived in a constant state of daydreaming that somehow I would end up in a game of basketball with Barack Obama. So, just that proximity, you know, just having him and also knowing that his list tends toward books about social justice, about poverty, about, you know, things that I'm naturally drawn to as a writer, and also maybe a kind of philosophical connection, you know. It was really cool. Yeah, it was great.
That is so cool. Did he make any connection with you? Were you able to communicate with him at all?
No, I think he fears probably my crossover. I think
obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think he can handle a bigger player, but I think someone with my 55-year-old speed probably terrifies him. So no, I did end up sending him a copy of The Cold Millions. I think, you know, the sort of love letter to labor would also appeal to him.
Right.
So hopefully at some point while we're both still walking, he and I'll end up on a court together.
Right. Well, he had that the highlight sometime during the pandemic. You know how time doesn't really exist anymore. Where he, well, maybe it was before. Oh, yeah, he had a mask on, so I know it was. And he basically comes in, you know,
nice clothing everywhere, and he just picks up the ball, and, you know, money's a three-pointer, right, with that lefty.
I don't know about left-handers' jumpers, but they just have a lever quality, you know.
Oh, man. So, yeah. You know, who knows how many takes it took, but we'll say it was just one. Yeah. What is it true that you are equally legendary on the basketball court as you are behind the typewriter, behind the computer? That you're the greatest to come out of Eastern Washington, Spokane, and they fear you on the playground. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, there's pretty much me and then Stockton.
Okay.
Yeah. No, okay. I am. I'm probably. It's funny to say among writers, I'm a good basketball player, which is sort of like among auto mechanics, I'm a good ballet dancer. They're such non-connecting concentric circles. That's the tiniest Venn diagram ever. So for a writer, I'm a decent basketball player. And I have a lot of friends who, I did not play in college, I played in high school. I have friends who played in college. And I think the further you have the fall, the more precipitous that is. And my game really didn't get any worse from about 18 to 43.
Okay.
And so I became sort of a pretty good rec league slash, you know, we used to have a great literary basketball team, Sherm Alexie, Shan Ray, and I, Natalie Diaz played with us once.
Oh, okay.
We were called the Spokane Dirty Realists. So we played a couple of different colleges. We used to play at writing festivals at AWP and Tin House and stuff like that. So,
oh, wow.
But yeah, I love the game. I think in terms of it, my aspirations were all toward playing professional basketball and being a writer. And so those two things are tied up in my mind somehow as equally unlikely and joyous things.
Oh, wow. Well, you, of course, are living in the area of Gonzaga basketball, number one in the nation at this point.
Yeah, they're right? Just so good. What a fun offensive team to watch. Yeah, I've watched them forever, obviously, and go to games and have played against a lot of those guys because they show up in the gyms. But this team is, I think, just doesn't have any weaknesses. They're so good.
They have so much depth. We'll talk about Spokane in just a minute. I appreciate reading about it. My dad played at Gonzaga, freshman basketball.
Oh, really?
Probably would have been 1968 under Bud Presley.
Wow. That's
right. I have a great connection to Gonzaga, and you know, I love reading about Spokane and the work that you do. Last question about basketball, maybe the last question, we'll see, but have you been able to play at all during the pandemic?
I played every day when the sun was out and when I could.
Okay, right.
I would just go shoot. My brother and I invented this game, this social distance one-on-one game, where we'd have to find an empty full court. He'd shoot on one and I'd shoot on the other. And you basically play to 100 by twos and threes.
Whoa.
But you play at the right outdoor court, the ball hits the double rim and then skids away. It was a good workout. And you could only shoot per quarter, you could shoot three layups each worth 1 point, and you had to shoot five free throws each worth 1 point. And then the rest were either elbow jumpers or threes.
Oh my gosh, you got to mess around, huh?
No. And it was, and jeez. These were, so you played by quarters, first one like 25, first one okay. 50. So I might be up at halftime 50 to 46, and then first one to 75. So he's got to outscore me by that much, getting to 75. And then you get to 100, and if you're within two shots, we also had a four-point shot from the center circle. Like, I think we have pretty good range. And so if you're within two shots, you get to take two shots to try to tie it. And
oh, my gosh.
So I might be up 192. You get 2 4-pointers to try to tie it and send it to overtime. And there's so anyway, we start playing this
Whoa.
Game, and then all of our friends come out of the woodwork, and pretty soon we have to find 4 empty courts.
Mm-hmm.
It became almost like a league. But then winter came, and
yeah,
we stopped. But that was that. That's pretty much. I used to just sort of get into park games and YMCA games.
Uh-huh.
Played some, you know, rec league-y things, but I'm in my mid-50s now, and a couple of really nasty injuries have made me not want to play the hard games.
Yeah. I think one of the stories to be written about the pandemic, and it's obviously very low on the priority list, is some of us are kind of being eased into retirement, right?
Oh man. So you played before and
I did. And you know, I want to be able to be good. I want to be able to not be the last guy picked, if you will. And I'll be playing for a while. I'll be 41 in a month.
Oh yeah. You got, you know. I feel like you're just coming into your prime.
Okay. I like that.
Yeah.
Like a fine wine. I like it.
Yeah. My neighbor has played into his late 60s and he won the Washington State senior games with his team. Actually, he's played into his 70s, I'm sorry. And yeah. So they got to play the Sonics Legends. And so he got to guard James Donald.
Okay.
About 6'6", 6'7". What a thrill. I'm like one of those golfers who wasn't very good, but somehow imagines he'll play on the senior tour. I want to go against Slick Watts someday. Well, I think Slick
Watts.
I want to go against Gary Payton someday.
Oh, yeah, the glove. So in a week, I think a week from now, I'm going to have John Finkel on. And John Finkel has a book out called Hoops Heist, right? Talking about Slick Watts and Seattle and just it's very insular in a positive way, but that the basketball community. So there's a book rec for you.
Seattle's a great basketball town. I saw Sean Kemp just opened his own pot dispensary, which is the most connective Seattle moment ever, you know. You can go buy weed from Sean Kemp. That just feels like the universe has found better.
Well, I thought the wound might be a little bit fresh. I was going to say this is episode 35, the Kevin Durant episode. But we'll move on.
He's dead to me. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about growing up in Spokane, about not just growing up there, but about your literary influences as a kid. If you were in a print-rich environment, kind of who were some of those writers and some of the genres that you were into as a kid and as an adolescent? And that was kind of a big question.
It is. I mean, it's always, you end up doing a kind of myth-making when you recreate your past. But no, I grew up in a really blue-collar family. I'm the first male in my direct line to go to graduate high school, let alone go to college. And so, but when I was 5, I got a stick in my left eye and that I had to basically take a year off of playing outside. And I think that's really what made me a reader. My mom and my aunts pulling me on their laps and reading to me. And that's really when I remember falling in love with books. And I loved adventure stories and pirate stories. I think because I wore an eye patch, I especially loved Treasure Island, anything with pirates. And so, and then it was sort of science fiction for a while.
Okay.
And science fiction led me to Vonnegut, honestly. And that was my first sort of 11, 12, 13, and realizing that my name would come after his in the library. And if I wrote funny, great books with drawings of assholes in them, maybe someday I would slide in next to Vonnegut.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's that. And I think just his combination of his humanism and his humor and his inventiveness, and that it felt like play, connected with me in a way. And so I think from about 12 or 13 on, I wanted to be a writer. And from then on, it was, we lived next to a drive-in movie theater. We lived on a cattle ranch for a while and then next to a drive-in movie theater. And so I sort of skipped that period where you read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and all and fantasy and went straight to hard 1970s cinematic realism, you know, like Dog Day Afternoon and Midnight Express. And so I kind of loved that kind of writing, Carver and things like that. And then you go through your Hemingway and Fitzgerald phase. And I sort of quickly realized I loved journalism and nonfiction and kind of fell in love with Joan Didion as a writer and a human being. And
Sacramento's finest,
yeah. Terrific writer about California. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a period. And I think I was just a big fan. I wrote a piece about stalking the writers that I loved. And So I sort of, you know, pretended to be working for a magazine to interview Vonnegut one time, and wrote letters to Joan Didion that she answered at one point.
Wow.
So I think I sort of went through a period in my late teens, early, maybe 21, 22, where I sort of expected that if I bugged enough writers, one of them would notice the genius in me. And yeah, so I think, I guess if I could trace a line, you know, through my own writing, it would be that way.
Hmm. So, you know, when Donald Trump would call, you know, journalists and stuff to brag about himself, he was, I think, John Barron. Were you Jess Walter when you called Kurt Vonnegut, et cetera? Were you?
Yeah, well, what happened was he came to Gonzaga University to speak, and I had done this before. I was a journalism student, and so I would call wherever an author was coming to speak, and I would say, hey, I'm writing a piece. Can I get press credentials? And so I would have to go hear Ken Kesey and Tom Wolfe. And,
wow.
And so when Vonnegut came, I'm like, oh my God, my hero's coming to town. So I called Gonzaga and said, and I wanted to make sure I got it. So I kind of upped the credential, you know, where I was working. And so I showed up, and at the other events, there'd been three or four or five reporters, TV reporter and the actual newspaper reporter who covered, you know, at the time there was a book reviewer at the paper. And so I sort of thought it would be that with Vonnegut, but I showed up and it was just him and me. And
I was
sitting across from my idol, and the student body president who brought him in, that was the associate students of Gonzaga who brought him in, you know, said, this is Jess Walter, and then left. And so I sitting across, and I'm like, if you can give advice to a young writer. And I was such a baby at the time, I was so young. And he sort of looked at me and said, how old are you? And I said, 20. And he said, and you're working for Esquire, which is what I had lied and said.
Oh, wow.
Well, they haven't actually accepted the piece. But he kindly sat and talked to me for a while. And I ended up, you can Google that story. It ran in an alternative paper 20.
Oh, I will check it out.
20 years after I interviewed him, or 18 years after I interviewed him.
Wow.
And then he, his publicist saw it and emailed me, gave Vonnegut my address, and he sent me a signed book after the piece finally appeared, which
very
was
very cool.
Yeah, it was wow. Very cool.
Have you read Tobias Wolff's Old School?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, the when they're the pieces they're writing for the visiting poet.
Well, that brings up another point I'll talk about in a minute, is that how incredible you are at writing within writing, where, like, in your two most recent novels, for example, you have song lyrics, or you have, like, you know, from the point of view of the person within, but, yeah. But right. So in that book, I'm sorry, it would be Robert Frost, right? Was the visiting poet. And, have you seen that in your lifetime? And again, when I say your lifetime, you're very young, of course, but have you seen that kind of change in the author as celebrity, you know, like a Hemingway was known just as much as LeBron James, or I don't know if that's the best comparison, but have you seen that change? And if so, you know, how do you think that came about?
Wow. Yeah. You know, I think early on I might have connected being a writer to fame. The further I got along in it, and the little bit of Hollywood that I bumped into, and the writers I knew who had to deal with it, I saw that it was the sort of the opposite thing that you'd want as a writer, that it would get in the way, and that it would, you know, so many things clog your voice. Oh, and I think fame would do that more than anything. I found myself one year on the rooftop of Jay McInerney, or McInerney, I never know how to pronounce it. And I used to think that he
Easton Ellis?
Fred Easton Ellis were sort of the last two writers, as I put it, the last two writers who dated models.
Okay. You know?
So they were kind of the last sex symbol writers. And I think the world's far better for not having writers be sex symbols, because nothing's less sexy than a writer. They and they shouldn't be. They should occupy a totally different place in the world, you know. But yeah, I remember, you know, the fame that he had, and you know, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you're on magazine covers and gossip columns are writing about you. And I don't think that's a very great place for a contemplative artist to spend their time.
Sure.
And I think it ruined far more writers, you know, that sort of fame. Hemingway too, you know, I mean.
Right.
I don't know what you can say about a writer who chooses, you know, the path that he did, and whose own battle against his own voice, you know, was so, you know, I think he became such a parody of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to have seen the books that, you know, someone like McInerney would have written if he hadn't, you know, been a
variant, yeah.
Model's famous writer.
Well, might have been, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, I do think it's shifted a little bit, but there to a place, but I don't know. I don't think that was the norm. And I don't think that was the way it should have been. I feel like this is, you know, there are so many writers whose work I love, who I would not recognize in an airport. And I think that's kind of the way it should be.
Right. So. The Chills of Will podcast, the name of my podcast, is based on a Tobias Wolff short story.
Oh, yeah. Which one?
It's The Bullet in the Brain.
Oh, but that's from Bullet in the Brain?
Yes. So this was when, it's an incredible piece, right?
Yeah.
Incredible piece. And the context of it is basically this idea that as he's contemplating his life, he talks about what he does remember and what he doesn't remember.
What's the line over the baseball glove? It's, what is it that he says?
They is.
Yeah.
Yes. Incredible work. And it was in the context of he did not remember lines from his youth that gave him thrills at will.
Yeah.
Right. And Aeschylus and this kind of thing. I'm wondering.
Sorry, man.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, if anything comes to mind for you, excerpts or lines or, you know, from books, stories, poems that you can almost like summon at will that give you chills at will. I'm sure there are thousands, but.
Yeah, there are so many. I think the one that stands out to me the most, again, being a working class kid, I went to a commuter college. Mm-hmm. I was a dad at 19. I almost quit college to go to work at the aluminum factory where my dad worked. And so my dream of being a writer at about 19 hit a wall right around the time I was pretending to be an Esquire reporter interview volunteer. And so I thought I would spend my life working at my hometown newspaper. And, but I remember being 19 or 20 years old and having a baby daughter and coming home from, I was in college and I was working at a pizza place and as a campus security guard and all these different jobs. And I had this brief window when I got to watch my baby daughter. And I remember taking her to the park and reading 100 Years of Solitude by García Márquez. And that very first sentence, many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendía would remember that distant afternoon when his father first took him to discover ice.
And
it was as if I had been seeing in black and white, and all of a sudden it was that scene in The Wizard of Oz when the world is in color, you know. And to create something as vivid and complete and full as that, and the more of the book I read, the more it became a sort of elusive thing that I couldn't quite get my arms around. I couldn't even find what I would normally call a plot. It was just stories unraveling and this sort of like more flowers over here and then, you know, jungle and garden there until it circles back around to that end. And in the last paragraph of the piece, you have the phrase, you know, a family that lives in 100 years of solitude, you know. And so just the both verbally and structurally, I think that changed what I thought that writing could do. And in the same way, I was drawn to the play of Vonnegut and the sheer icy technical prowess of Joan Didion. Here was someone who was just expansive and explosive in a way that I kind of longed to also try to emulate.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I guess it still exists. I had a Twitter account before this that probably has 2 or 3 tweets. And you were the first, the name of the account is Dynamic Last Lines.
Oh yeah.
And the first one was the last line, the last couple of lines from Beautiful Ruins.
Yeah.
Which we'll have you read in a little bit. And I mean, those are truly chilling lines in the most positive of senses. And yeah, that's great that you.
And I think you try to give yourself that as a reader. And in the end, I trust when I do that. You know, there's a story in We Live in Water where, you know, two meth addicts are trying to pawn a giant tilt television, a big screen television. And I'm writing it, not quite sure where it's going. And all of a sudden, you know, and they have all these adventures, and I started imagining it was like Odysseus, but with meth addicts, you know. and then they start relating what's happened, and they're laughing about it the way my brother and I do about the time our car broke down. It's not funny during the moment, but afterward. And then one of them says to the other, when this shit was happening, it wasn't so funny. Maybe remembering is better than living. And just you know, again, like you say, the chill that you get from the sound of the sentence, but also from thinking you might have stumbled on something sort of true, you know, that synthesis of literature and that synthesis of language and thought and belief, you know, I think that's what you write for in a way. Right. And so I think if I've done anything as a writer, as I've sort of taught myself how to write books, which I felt like I sort of had to do, it's to find those, to really trust in my own reactions as a reader to my own stuff.
Could you remind me the name of that story you referenced, the with the TV?
Wheelbarrow Kings. Yeah,
I'd forgotten the title, but that's a great one. You brought it back, just that battle they had with that TV.
Yeah.
Right. I think of those, you know, those old TVs that are so heavy. Now everyone's got the flat screen, even this one in back of me, which is kind of maybe halfway there, but just so heavy. I mean, just a battle and.
Oh, the rear projection. Yeah. And I really did see two guys. I don't know that they were going to a pawn shop, but I did see two guys pushing a TV like that on a wheelbarrow one time. And I just, my sorrow for, you know, had to help my brother move one of those one time.
So obviously you're not a Johnny Come Lately. You've been doing great work for many years. You know, you wrote about Ruby Ridge. Was that, and you know, some of the nonfiction was more in the earlier days, right?
Yeah. That kind of came out of my journalism career. I was a newspaper reporter for 7 or 8 years, covered crime. Okay. So some of my early fiction was because that was the world I knew, but also I don't have an MFA. My BA is suspect and very much a self-taught and writer. And so early on, I thought I'm going to write the things that I know how to do. And so, yeah, Ruby Ridge was my first book, which came out of my reporting of that. And I'm really proud of that book. And its even-handedness, its fairness, which is an attribute that I came up with as a reporter that I still think is, you know, when people read that, I think the idea that I trust them to intellectually grasp what's happening if they have all the information is something that I miss about journalism.
I've been privileged to just speak with some great writers. Jeff Perlman recently, the sports writer.
That's
I don't want to limit him. He's a great writer and not just a sports writer, but he talks about also starting out on the late night crime beat. How did that kind of, what were you taught there? How did that help kind of inform your later writing?
You know, I think one thing it taught me was that wild, violent, amazing things happen every day. Honestly, a lot of writers I think are shy to broach certain subjects, and I understand why. Violence and crime and things like that can really take things over. But among the first things I wrote about were Ruby Ridge and the O.J. Simpson murder trial. I had covered three serial killers before I turned 30.
Whoa.
I had seen my first dead body at 19, you know? And so I think that first, I think just the curiosity of reporters, your job is to go find out stuff. You have to pull people aside and talk to them. It doesn't reward a meek curiosity. It rewards a bold one. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and the understanding of how systems work, and then maybe a lack of preciousness about publishing. You don't ever publish anything perfect as a reporter. And so I think I was less afraid of publishing somewhat unfinished work, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then the chops, you know, it really fit me as a blue collar kid to start it as a newspaper. Because it's a blue collar, white collar job. And,
mm-hmm. We would be talking for 8 hours if we were to go into great depth, because you have so much good material out there. Skipping forward a bit to Two Beautiful Ruins.
Yeah.
And which is fiction. Would you call it historical fiction?
I really don't like any classifications on books.
Okay.
Only because it always feels sort of reductive to me. Mm-hmm. If fans of historical fiction want to call it that, it does venture around from the Donner Party to World War II. But I don't think, I always think of historical fiction as being rooted in that, in a historical moment. And if there's anything about that book, it's that it's not rooted, you know, it floats and flows. And so I think it's really more, I don't know what I would call it. You know, just a novel. So.
I mean, it's clear that your journalism skills have helped you become such a great fiction writer. The way that you weave in the different stories, you know, there's Michael Dean, who's, you know, gotten 30 million plastic surgeries, and yeah. I don't know, like what Robert Evans type, or what's his name, the Tan Man, Hamilton, George Hamilton, and you know, all these guys mixed together, right? And yeah. You talked about the Donner Party, which was this kind of movie within the book, right? Like a screenplay within the book, all the different storylines. I would love to know about the epigraph. You talk about a chills of will line. I read somewhere that was what spurred you on to call it Beautiful Ruins. And I don't know if you would mind reading that. I don't know if you have it handy or not.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. The epigraph is actually from, there were three.
Right.
There, the ancient Romans built their greatest masterpieces of architecture for wild beasts to fight in. And then a line from Cleopatra, which I call the 1963 disaster film, Cleopatra. Cleopatra, I will not have love as my master. Mark Antony, then you will not have love. And then this from a story by Louis Menand in The New Yorker from 2010. And it was actually about Dick Cavett, but it was this line about Richard Burton, who's a character in the novel. Cavett's four great interviews with Richard Burton were done in 1980. Burton, 54 at the time, and already a beautiful ruin, was mesmerizing. Yeah, the novel was going to be called the Hotel Adequate View, which is, of course, the name of the Italian hotel. Mm-hmm. But it didn't feel right to me as I was working on it. A similar thing happened with The Cold Millions. I don't know how you can know the title of something until you've written it, you know. Mm. It's like how you can know anything about a relationship until you have it. And so it was two-thirds of the way through my fourth draft of the novel, 13 years into it, 12 years into it, realizing that I had written Richard Burton as a character and doing research, that I came across that line as in my research. And I got a shiver, and I said, oh, this is a book about a state of ruination, of our dreams no longer being what they were, of me not playing in the NBA, but being maybe a more interesting basketball player than I would have been, you know, for the path that I've taken. And and for these characters specifically, you know, Pasquale's dream of building this Italian Riviera outpost for Americans, and the life he chooses being more dignified and interesting, and that for all the characters. And so that that moment of realizing that the book you're writing is called this is was pretty thrilling. Similar thing happened with The Cold Millions, which I, at the time, there was another line in the book that I knew I was writing this thing that I wanted to skirt sort of Western archetypes. And so I thought it would maybe be called Nothing West of Dead. Because I loved that line in the book. And I thought, oh, it's going to be like sort of a hard boiled, you know, Western thing. And then I'm writing a scene with Rye in this library, and he's sitting there, you know, thinking about his brother. He's in a millionaire's library surrounded by books that the millionaire will never read. And his brother, who has no money in the world, but trades everything he has for some, you know, random scraps of War and Peace. And so Rye has this moment, I'll just read it if that's all right. Rye has this moment in which he thinks about his brother and the unfairness that he won't be in this place. And so he says,
you need a control F feature for a hard copy book.
Yeah. Rye flushed with sadness as if every moment of his life were occurring all at once. His sister dying in childbirth, his mother squirming in that one room flop, poor Danny sliding between wet logs, Gig in jail and Jules dead, and how many more? All people except this rich cream, living and scraping and fighting and dying, and for what? Nothing. The cold millions with no chance in this world. And writing that line, I had this instant vision that it, The Cold Millions describes the millions of people like Rye who are born without the advantages and will never have a chance at them because of the sort of mythic American, you know, life that that they've been sold, but also the coldness of the millionaires who, use their labor in that way. And so it just felt like at that moment, I thought, oh, this is the book I'm writing. And I think a title can have that same sort of synthesis that one of those great lines can have. It can make you focus more on the task at hand, on the thematic strands that you're that you're maybe unwittingly pulling together, that on your third and fourth and fifth and sixth revisions, you know, you can pull a little tighter, hopefully without straining them.
I think, and I mean it in the most complimentary of ways, that both of these books, The Cold Millions and Beautiful Rooms, they resist being able to be summarized in a few sentences. There's so much going on. You do such an incredible job with the different storylines. It's, you know, the flashbacks, the flash forwards, and to have the juxtapositions. One of my favorites, my favorite movie scene of all time is The Godfather Part II, the last scene.
Yeah.
Right? Because you get to see the cold Michael Corleone, maybe literally in Tahoe after just dispatching his brother.
Yeah.
Versus when he was an innocent, you know, Joe College.
On the train. So,
right?
The one at the dinner table. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And he says, I have my own plans for my future. Yeah. And he's, you know, got some good intentions. But I guess what I'm asking is, how did you write, like, the different characters and points of view separately? Did you write it in a linear-ish fashion? How did you, because, you know, when you see a character again, it's just like, oh. It's just such a cool way of building suspense and tension and chills.
Yeah, I love that scene too, now that you mention it. The I remember getting an email from a woman who said, well, I read your novel, Beautiful Ruins. Now, please, I don't know why you want to mess with us that way. Please email me the chronological novel.
Oh, no.
And the assumption that I had, you know, somehow taken apart this thing that worked. I feel like one of the few advantages that books have over every other medium is the way they can play with time. The investment of time in the reader, you know, you don't watch this over 2 hours. You watch it as you read it and you absorb it, you play it yourself. Mm-hmm. And to get to get invested in a character and then see them later but also get to see them earlier in that great flashback you're describing,
right?
You know, it it makes connections in ways that we couldn't otherwise. So mm-hmm. No, I don't really think of them chronologically. The first thing I wrote of the Cold Millions was Gig and Rye waking up in his field. The second thing I wrote was, a scene on a ferry boat 50 years earlier. The next thing I wrote was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn arriving in town. I sort of pieced together things more in that way. With Beautiful Ruins, I think it was really me imagining all that can happen with time and with regret, which is sort of the underlying thing. There's another epigraph in that, in Beautiful Ruins, that comes at the beginning of the last chapter, which is this line from Milan Kundera: "There would be nothing more obvious, more tangible than the present moment, and yet it eludes us completely. All the sadness of life lies in that fact." And I think that's what fiction can do. It can give you an awareness of the present moment by flashing you forward and back, by placing it on a line of chronology that normally we don't have access to. We don't live above time that way, except when we're reading a novel. And so to get to play with time, there's something in me that just loves play, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's playful and fun to do that. But I think the larger thematic thing you can do is that thing Kundera is talking about, make you aware of the fragility of the present moment.
I was looking forward in the acknowledgments. In the acknowledgments, which is so well done, you answer so many questions about, how much of this is fiction. And, there are some important historical characters involved in the labor movement, the IWW. But you say it very well, like, this is my fictionalized version of so-and-so in this fictionalized city.
Yeah.
So you kind of have the outlines of them.
I think I did that. I think that was the old journalist in me saying, because it's an exaggerated version in some ways, I've invented some scenes. Most of the historical characters really do sort of follow the track they were on. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, really did most of the things that I show her doing in the novel.
Right.
And said most of those things. And so I both wanted people to know that what they'd read had such a basis in fact, but I also wanted to show them the path that I'd taken to get there. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like being coy and, either pretending this had no basis in fact at all. A lot of times I think we want that, auto fiction sort of plays that coy game of saying like, well, sure, the character's named me and does everything I do, but it's not me, and
thinly veiled memoir type of thing.
Yeah, right. There's something in the importance of a life like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's and the fact that she's not a character that historically has made the turn, really, that I felt deserved better than me being coy about what was real and what wasn't.
Well, the Cold Millions will send a lot of future readers, like it did me, to Wikipedia. You want to know a little bit more about the real person. Yeah. If we could finish up, I could talk to you for hours. I thank you so much for all this information. Great to talk literature. The ending of the Cold Millions is that, is it called the afterword? I forget the exact.
Epilogue.
It is epilogue. You're right. Pardon me. And it's so cool because, the beginning of the book is very specific to one character. Then obviously the book branches out to more characters. And then we get a wider view at the end, wider as in the character Rye is much older, but it's also very specific to his situation. It's just such a beautiful way to do it. And the ending has so much more gravitas because of the fact that it's him looking back. He's not a kid anymore.
Right. Yeah.
He's able to look back over his life. I wonder if you could finish with the last piece of A Beautiful Ruins, which is, I will tell people listening or watching, if you're going to read it, it's kind of a plot spoiler, I guess, maybe, not in the normal way because it's not as much of a linear book, but it is incredible. But honestly, if you don't want the plot to be spoiled a bit, then step away. but we'd be honored if you could read the last part of A Beautiful, Beautiful Ruins.
It does spoil it.
Well, you know better than I do.
I'm going to take...
you know better than I do.
I'm going to take Kundera at his word that those that moving in and out of time is doesn't spoil it, but enriches it.
There you go. Okay, I like that.
One quick thing about the end of The Cold Millions, that War and Peace sort of serves as the model for that book, and reading the long epilogue in War and Peace really made me feel like there's something subversive in the past way that people used to write books sometimes, that 19th century birth to death thing. And I felt this great joy at sort of mimicking the structure of War and Peace, the four sections and the epilogue. So it was something that I didn't know until I got there that I was going to be able, that I would like it as much as it sounds like you did. So it's great to hear that.
I'm sorry, one real quick. Yes, I mean, the War and Peace, kind of that parallel storyline, and just the idea of Rye as a 16, 17-year-old kid, and how for us, episodes in our lives, that's everything when we're in it, right?
Yeah.
And just this idea, like, I think Andre, the character, where it's like seeing yourself like, this is it. I'm with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. This is it. And then after, it's like, well, I barely ever saw her again, and she kind of fell out of my life. And just in that moment, it seems like it's everything. So
yeah, and I think, again, so many of these things are sort of writing technical things that then become thematic, and then become not only thematic but elemental. You know, you can't imagine the book without it. And that process, I never know what those are going to be. I don't really outline until I'm done, and then I outline to see what I've done. And I think to end with Beautiful Ruins is, I tend to think of books, I don't think of plot as a series of things happening so much as a shape. And that inherent shape of The Cold Millions is the river that's the center of it. And that third person Gig and Rye story is like the main part of the river. And then you have these first person tributaries crashing in until at the end, it's Rye's first person. And that felt to me like the structure of it, you know. And in the same way, Beautiful Ruins always felt to me like this. It's interesting. We talked about that first sentence of 100 Years of Solitude, because with the first sentence of Beautiful Ruins, which I'll read as a way to read into the last paragraph.
Okay.
I wanted to write a big, rich, like, I've always thought that first sentence of 100 Years of Solitude is an entire novel. And I wanted to write a first sentence that felt like an entire novel, which is, the dying actress arrived in his village the only way one could come directly, in a boat that motored into the cove, lurched past the rock jetty, and bumped against the end of the pier. Now you've got the dying actress the same way in 100 Years of Solitude. You've got before he faced the firing squad, and then you've got physical details. And so it's a sort of, how long can you suspend the thing that you're promising, you know, which is this dying actress. And then at the end of the book, Pasquale and Dee find themselves 50 years later back on the Italian Riviera, completing that movement that big sweeping boat circle that I imagined. They finish their breakfast in Porto Venere, go to the hotel and put on hiking boots. Dee assures Pasquale that she's up for this, and they take a taxi to the end of the road, crowded now with cars and walkers and the bicycles of tourists. At a turnaround, he helps her out of the cab, pays the driver, and they set off once more on a trail along a vineyard, leaning up into the park, up into the striated foothills that serve as backdrop to the sea-scraped cliffs. They have no idea if the paintings have faded away or have been spray painted with graffiti, or if the bunker still exists, or for that matter, if it ever existed at all. But they are young and the trail is wide and easily traveled. And even if they don't find what they're looking for, isn't it enough to be out walking together in the sunlight?
Yeah, yeah. That's a 10 out of 10 right there. It's a 12 out of 10 with you reading it. It's a 14 out of 10 once you've read the earlier parts that build up to that, that make that even more,
more special. I question your scale holding up.
I appreciate that. So. I don't know if that makes mathematical sense.
I don't think it does, but I still like it. Yeah.
To be able to speak to you about your own writing, to be able to hear you read your own, it's just been such a privilege.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you so much for joining me. I will treasure this.
Yeah, great talking to you. We'll find ourselves on the basketball court someday.
We will, and we will. I wish you
one-on-one.
I wish you great luck and you continued riding and take care. Thank you so much.
Thanks. You too. Take care.
All righty.
Wow. So yeah, that just happened. A huge thank you to Jess Walter. That was an incredible experience and truly one that I'll remember forever. Thank you for listening to episode 35 with Jess Walter. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find the pod on Spotify and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at chillsatwillpo1. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version, and the other great song played on the episode is Hoops, instrumental, by Matt Whitehour, and both songs are used through archesaudio.com. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Jess Walter, whose Beautiful Ruins and The Cold Millions, among so many other masterpieces, give you chills at will.